Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Dan Washburn. For much of the past year, a widespread protest movement has roiled Hong Kong. Initially, the demonstrations began when the territory's government passed an extradition law that left Hong Kong residents vulnerable to the justice system in mainland China. But even the withdrawal of the bill hasn't quelled the movement. Now it represents something far greater, the perilous future of autonomous Hong Kong itself. Is the one country, two systems framework governing Hong Kong's relationship with China still alive? What lies ahead in 2020? And looking further down the road, what might happen in 2047, when Beijing is scheduled to regain full control? The future of Hong Kong forms the basis of the new book, Vigil, Hong Kong on the Brink. Its author, Jeffrey Wasserstrom, is a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. He places the recent events in Hong Kong in a broader historical context and considers whether the territory will ever return to the way things were before the protests began. Wasserstrom recently discussed his new book at Asia Society New York with New Yorker correspondent Jiayang Fan and Chinaphile editor Susan Jakes.
It seems kind of like the whole world is on the brink. Why should we be paying attention to Hong Kong? Why are you paying attention to Hong Kong?
In some ways, it was much easier to say why pay attention to Hong Kong in the summer when some of the biggest marches in the history of the world were taking place there. Some of the biggest marches, certainly by percentage of a political community, that were turning out on the streets. And it was extraordinary. And a movement was going on. It was the longest sustained social movement in any part of the People's Republic of China in 30 years. The umbrella movement before that had been the longest sustained movement in any part of the People's Republic of China in more than a quarter century. So Hong Kong keeps setting the bar there. But now, you know, between the time just a few weeks ago when people were saying, boy, your book is coming out at such a timely moment, Hong Kong's on everybody's mind. The virus is on everybody's mind. But I think in some ways, the virus underscores why the fight in Hong Kong is one that people globally should care about. Not just people who care about Hong Kong, not just people who care about China, because I think what's crucial, and if we go back to SARS, which I know you covered and helped break the stories of, it was crucial that there was an independent press in Hong Kong that was close to the mainland, had access to the mainland, and could report in ways that it was harder or impossible to do on the mainland, and that helped undermine cover-ups. If that goes away in Hong Kong, we're all in danger of not getting information that the mainland wants to suppress. So here we have a leader in Beijing who's obsessed with control, and there are all kinds of ways that Hong Kong has been a place that can move against cover-ups. So there have been moves against cover-ups of corruption within the party, and these might be things that people across China definitely care about. But the virus shows that this is also something that we far from China should care about as well. So Hong Kong's fight is really at a cutting edge, even as it disappears a little bit more from view right now.
And just to add on to that, I mean, I think that's a very important point, Jeff. When I was in Hong Kong last year in September covering the protests, something that came up quite frequently when I talked to mainlanders, and even when I talked to my mother, who is a mainlander, was the seeming irrelevance of what was happening in this tiny island. I mean, for someone like my mother, I mean, someone of her generation, she was largely annoyed. But there was this sense that what was happening over there was incredibly abstract, that, you know, that the values that the young protesters were fighting for, like democracy, like representational government, were things that didn't have very much to do with the everyday lives of 1.4 billion people on the mainland. What the novel coronavirus brings to bear is literally the critical nature to their lives of a free press and of transparency and of a government that cares more about the public welfare of its people rather than control, as Jeff mentioned. So even though it seems like we're skipping so quickly from Hong Kong is the epicenter of crisis to Wuhan now as the ground zero for different kind of crisis. They are intimately related in the way that, in the sense that Wuhan concretizes the abstract principles that young protesters are fighting for, and that notion, you know, that the protesters in Hong Kong were called Fei Qing, right? Like these wasted youths, the sense that they are spoiled and that they are they don't have anything better to do. And here we have, I mean, as many of you probably know, the death of Dr. Li, one of the first whistleblowers of the virus in Wuhan, and how his death feels so connected to almost every single person in on the mainland, and that feels incredibly impactful.
I was going to ask you about this very issue. I mean, there was this, you know, when the protests were at their height this summer, one of the things that the protesters did was sing, "Do you hear the people sing?" from Les Miserables, and now people are singing that same song on the mainland, but I wonder, do you have any, either of you have any sense, like, is anybody, have you seen anything on social media that suggests that people in the mainland are actually making this analogy themselves? Or do you think it's easier for us to see from the outside?
So that it has always been the sort of greatest fear of Beijing, or my biggest concern about protests
contagion.
In Hong Kong, is that contagion
and
was spread across the border.
All this vocabulary has become so newly relevant.
Yeah. And it's percolated. Well, China File just published a very important piece by Xu Zhangrun, a critical intellectual within the mainland, which was a searing criticism of trends under Xi. But then Xu Zhangrun was also involved with a group letter that was just released. And in that group letter written by critical mainland intellectuals, they said, we have five demands, which was, in that case, I think, an homage.
Explain.
To Hong Kong. In Hong Kong now, the protests have been led, had the slogan, five demands, not one less. It began with one demand, an end to the extradition bill that was being proposed that would have made it easy for people that Beijing wanted to prosecute over the border to be taken from Hong Kong over the border. This was seen as a threat to Hong Kong's independent judiciary, its rule of law, and the protest began with the demand that that be withdrawn. And then as there was a great deal of police brutality and some militancy on the protest side, and then more police brutality, and then more militancy on the protesters' side, another key demand became an independent investigation of police misconduct. That, I think, is the one of the demands that, had the government addressed it, could have ratcheted down the movement at various points, because it has the broadest support across Hong Kong, is a feeling that the police are out of control. But they had three other demands as well, including universal suffrage for the chief executive. But the slogan then has become, five demands, not one less. This time, we're going to stay on the streets until we clearly know that things are in place to protect us, in the way that there's a critique of the umbrella movement of 2014 as ending too soon. So this is it. So the five demands, not one less, I think is a clear homage when they do it. But with
that's a very specific group of people.
That's very specific and unusual. The singing, I mean, well, do you hear the people sing from Les Mis? Has had global reach. The South Korean protests that brought down a corrupt official, the protesters were singing that then. And that actually connects to the other big Asia story in the news that's competing with Hong Kong and the virus, the film Parasite winning. So the maker of the film Parasite, I've at least read, was blacklist. Had South Korea continued to move in a kind of authoritarian direction, you might not have had that kind of film being made. So there are ways in which, and the song itself being sung globally in many different parts of the world. But there's one trick about, do you hear the people sing as it's sung in Hong Kong?
I just heard about this.
So I learned this from Tammy Ho, who's an amazing Hong Kong poet and translator.
In your book.
And she, yes, you read it on her book, and I read about it on her blog. So Tammy Ho is a translator, a poet, and the head of Hong Kong, the Hong Kong chapter of PEN, the writers group. And she wrote a blog post during the Umbrella Movement about the Cantonese translation of Do You Hear the People Sing? It's wonderful. You have to be able to sing songs when they're in translation, so there's often freedom in how you alter the words. In Cantonese, it means something more like, have you spoken out yet? So rather than calling on the officials to listen, it's calling on the people to join in. So it would be very interesting if the version that's being sung is, how come you aren't listening to us or listening to the whistleblower?
Yeah, oh, we should check that out. What about you? Have you?
Right. I think the virality of the song speaks to also this breakdown, I think, in this, and the idea of the five demands that people are making makes me think about the grand bargain that the Communist Party, you know, struck with the people ever since reform and opening back in the 80s. This sense that if the government can guarantee prosperity, then the people, then the masses will remain assiduously apolitical. And I think what is happening both in Hong Kong and in Wuhan really interrogates the notion that politics and social welfare can be so can be kept on these completely two different tracks. What really struck me in about what's happening in Wuhan, and I think what so many writers and commentators and journalists like myself are trying to get at, is that it's not that Beijing doesn't want to contain the virus. I mean, that in that sense, it is. The sincerity of the goal is absolutely there, because it threatens Beijing's legitimacy when it fails to do so. But the political structure as it exists, the top-down regime, I mean, its autocracy is such that despite its concerted effort to control the spread of the virus, that structure is incapable, I feel, of delivering that ultimate goal. So I think that really brings us to the existential crisis of this political regime, because it's no longer that the government has some alternative motive and, you know, it's not trying to do this thing. It realizes that unless it can guarantee the containment of the virus, its survival is threatened. But the dictatorial nature of government is such that guaranteeing something that is so fundamental to appeasing the masses, like, you know, keeping people safe, is not, you know, is something that is not, it might not be entirely capable of.
And the instinct is part of the reason why we're in this situation to begin with is that the system is set up to prioritize public order above everything else. And even as these efforts are taking place, there is also this concerted effort to, as Pamela Crossley, the great Qing historian, put it in an essay recently, to quarantine blame. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think those effort, you know,
yeah,
those things happening at the same time are probably not aiding the efficacy
exactly.
of the response.
And there's something so ironic about the fact that stability maintenance has always been the rallying cry of the government. And it was, in a way, it was that very goal that caused the first whistleblowers to be reprimanded in the first place. Like, they were perceived to be spreading rumors and causing chaos. And for the sake of stability, we need to mute them. And that was what caused, really, one of the reasons that led to the crisis getting so out of hand.
Right. And also the bureaucrats who were overseeing the city were very focused on the orderly performance of their annual
the
provincial meeting,
there is,
right?
Yeah,
and so, you know, the instinct to to kind of push any kind of problem aside. And then also the fact that they were so busy. I mean, somebody did a wonderful, a Chinese journalist did a wonderful piece that had the schedule of all of the high-level officials in Wuhan for the days when this news was beginning to spread. And they were all really busy getting ready for their big annual political meeting, which we were just saying, you know, was also the motive for suppressing information about SARS in 2003 because the outbreak was happening among medical workers in Beijing just as preparations were underway for the National People's Congress.
But what I think the virus has underscored for Hong Kong, getting back to the sort of enduring issues with Hong Kong, have been that there is something called one country, two systems, is the structure. And the idea was that when Hong Kong became part of the People's Republic of China, it would benefit from becoming part of a big country on the rise. But it would be protected from some, it wouldn't lose the things that made it special. So this is a year of the rat. It's just begun. And it's a very consequential year of the rat. The last year of the rat was also a very consequential year, 2008. And it had its disaster and the earthquake, but it also had the Olympic Games. And the Beijing Olympics, I think, was a time when one country, being part of one country, was a plus to a lot of people in Hong Kong. And there are even Hong Kongers now, young Hong Kongers, who are adamant participants in the protests, and even some of the ones who say, don't think of me as Chinese, think of me as a Hong Konger, who remember kind of, and they sometimes, you know, are sort of musing on this, that they were really excited when the Olympic Games were coming to China. And they felt that that reflected well on them, that they could take pride in that. And Beijing, I think, played the Olympics beautifully in this sense, because the big events were in Beijing that we focused on, but Hong Kong's a special place. The equestrian events were held there. So Hong Kong people got to kind of ride some of the crest of that. And in some ways, the two systems part seemed to be working out okay around 2008 in Hong Kong. In 2003, there was an effort to bring in a new sedition law.
Anti-sedition
law, right. And there were giant protests. And at that point, the government listened to the people sing, and they withdrew the bill. So around 2008, you had this thing, well, okay, two systems seem to be working.
That was right after SARS, actually.
Right after
SARS.
They had been kind of burned for their
management of
So they had SARS. Like some protection in this way. So you had that, but now, being part of one country, if your official doesn't listen to local experts or to local concerns, but listens to Beijing about how to handle the virus, then being part of one country is a real downside. And the two systems part doesn't really seem to be working. So I think the contrast between these 2 years of the rat is pretty dramatic.
I have a question about this. This summer, right at the height of the protests, right when the protesters were taking over the airport, two pro-democracy legislators from Hong Kong, one of whom is in the legal functional constituency, he's a lawyer, mm-hmm. but he's pro-democracy, Dennis Kwok, and the other one was Alvin Yung, came here to speak. And I asked them if they thought that part of what was motivating the protesters in Hong Kong had anything to do with the growing authoritarianism on the other side of the border. You know, Xi Jinping getting rid of his term limits, Xinjiang censorship. And they both said, no, it's not about that at all. Like, no, what do you guys think about that? I was a little surprised. But they said, no, it's really much more focused on the local, on local issues and on the way that the central government is manifesting itself in Hong Kong.
I think there's certainly an awareness of what's going on the mainland and a concern, and it's growing. I mean, now they're starting to be solid. There's discussion. I mean, I don't understand how to even. Yeah, no, I would disagree there.
Though I do. I mean, yeah, I think there must be some. I mean, I think it's hard to. Imagine it's hard to think that there is not a subconscious level even. I mean, this anxiety about what's going on the mainland. But I do think that, and as you know, Vigil described so well, Hong Kong is a very unique place. And when I can imagine how, if you're living there over the past couple decades. It's become this perfect storm of economic social and political anxieties. And there is a sense of a unique, and you might, as an inhabitant, think, I'm more concerned about the shape of my life than necessarily, the grand repercussions of what's going on in mainland affecting me in the next 5, 10 years. I think the anxieties in Hong Kong have become so acute, and the fear of the way that lives on the ground are being affected in this very concrete way that might make Hong Kongers believe, I'm not looking so far down the line about mainland's effect on me. It's, today, right now, I have real fears about the quality of my life.
I can imagine them a bit. You don't want to have your story always reduced to something else. And we saw a similar thing. There's no question that the Tsai Ing-wen victory in Taiwan was aided by the Hong Kong protests and the crackdown. But I can see why there were people in Taiwan who said, don't make that the story, because what we're doing has its own integrity. So I can see, it's not that it's not an either or. And they're so entwined. I've also had people ask, so why aren't the Hong Kong protests more about economic inequality? Hong Kong is so incredibly economically unequal. Why is it always focusing on
politics? The government thinks that that's part of what, a large part of what's bringing
the government thinks it's, and that's the kind of excuse. But it's all, you can't just neatly disentangle that. Mm-hmm. The powers that be in Hong Kong are seen as largely being tycoons who are in league with Beijing, and have come to terms with a way to operate. So political frustration links up with economic frustration. There was some hope about Carrie Lam, because finally she was a chief executive who wasn't out of that kind of group, but clearly she ended up doing the exact same things.
We're going to take a short break and talk about some upcoming live webcasts at asiasociety.org. On March 9th, our ongoing coverage of the coronavirus continues, a talk with economist Daniel Rosen about the economic costs of the crisis. The following day, we consider the effect of the trade war between the U.S. and China on global arts and culture. And on March 12th, journalist Dexter Roberts will speak about his new book, The Myth of Chinese Capitalism. To learn more about these events and find out how you can watch, please visit asiasociety.org/live. And now, let's get back to Jeffrey Wasserstrom, Jia Yangfan, and Susan Jakes.
How do you see the coronavirus outbreak affecting these dynamics? Or do you have any thoughts about that? Or where would you be looking to try to assess that?
I think it's not a coincidence. We were talking about this before the talk, how the sackings that came in today, the top official in Hubei, two of them have been sacked, and Zhang Xiaoming in the Macau and Hong Kong office, also another, two top officials have also been sacked. I think the coronavirus makes me think about Hong Kong in the sense of how does Beijing continue to send political signals that will be correctly and effectively interpreted in different in disparate regions of China. I think about the failure of Hubei and the failure of Hong Kong being, in addition to many other things, as one in which Carrie Lam and the mayor of Wuhan and the top officials of Hubei massively being derelict in their duty to really assess the needs and wants of their people and not prioritizing that, but instead feeling like they are absolutely obliged to make sure that they are following the dictates of Beijing 100%. And I think that actually is not, that is not to Xi Jinping's benefit, because if he doesn't have capable mid-level officials in Hubei, in Hong Kong, in all the other provinces in China who can interpret a signal from Zhongnanhai and apply it in an effective way to the and meet the demands of its people, then you will constantly be in danger of possible uprisings and revolts. And I think of, you know, Carrie Lam, and as you delineate so well in your book, Jeff, being a very potent example of that. She was, you know, she is a hyper competent yes woman, but she ultimately was not able to balance between what her constituents needed and also following, you know, the orders of Beijing. That was something that she, you know, epically failed to do.
Yeah. It's a longstanding pattern, though. I mean, I was realizing as I read your book that that all of these movements that you describe, beginning with Article 23, they're all responsive. I mean, it's not like they're... It's not about advancing, at least initially, about advancing an affirmative vision. It's about resisting protecting encroachment. And there's the anti-sedition law, and then, you know, the genesis of the students who would later become the umbrella movement was this move to rewrite the textbooks that middle school kids were learning, and then the middle school students organized themselves. So it just, I guess I wonder how you... and then this extradition bill, which right. We still don't think perfectly understand the dynamics of how that was proposed and why it wasn't withdrawn sooner when it seems like it could have avoided this big calamity. I wonder how you see the this whole dynamic of this constant reaching into Hong Kong in ways that seem to so aggravate sentiment there. Is it just that Beijing feels like it can afford to do that, or is it about some form of paranoia, or like what's causing it?
So going back, sort of putting on my historian hat, and I learned so much from journalists that, especially the ones who seem to be asking the same kinds of questions, and sometimes they do more, they go into, you had Mara Fistendahl here recently, and I was thinking her book reads more like a historian's book in some ways, and mine reads more like a journalist. But putting on my historian's hat, going at least back to 1996,
Jeff, and I'll is go also back. An historian of social movements. In China.
Yeah, I'll go back to 1841 if you want. But, for now, 1996. In the lead up to the handover, there was all sort of, Hong Kong's continually made fools of forecasters, but there were sort of two kinds of forecasts that were both wrong. And one was that right after the handover, all vestiges of free press would be gone. There would be no elections for legislators. It was just going to kind of instantly become like another mainland city. And that clearly just didn't happen. The other forecast, a more hopeful one that was also wrong, was that when Hong Kong, with its more liberal ways, became part of the Chinese body politic, its ways would permeate over the border and the press would become freer and Chinese cities would become more like Hong Kong. I mean, there were elements of both that were right. I mean, malls in Shanghai became a lot more like malls in Hong Kong. The eating scene in Chinese cities, the way to have fun, to make money, spend money, became more like Hong Kong. And in some ways, there were some things that crept over the border the other way. But on the whole, there was a kind of sense of relief. Like, look, you can still have the South China Morning Post making fun of the authorities. You still have some space.
In English.
And then at certain points, and even you had Apple Daily, you know, you had things that you couldn't have. So at a certain point, it becomes, well, you know, it was slow, maybe a very, very slow process of reining Hong Kong in. But then China changed. It became more, the Communist Party became more self-confident. It became more powerful in the world. I quote, Margaret Thatcher was saying in 1990, when asked if she was concerned about the fact that a British city was going to go into the go into the hands of a government that had just recently carried out the massacre. She said, but look, Deng Xiaoping is still committed to economic reform. Economic reform will ineluctably lead to some form of liberalization. And anyway, the Chinese Communist Party will want to be seen in the forum of the world as keeping its word. Hmm. And, you know, up to a certain extent, until about 2008, or certainly until they got into WTO, they were very important to be seen as in the forum of the world. Now, China, the forum of the world is just messed up. There isn't as clear a thing. And China is part of what's setting the agenda in the forum of the world. And it's in a strong position where it doesn't have to be as concerned with that. So a variety of things have changed. But then there's also the process at certain points, the authorities, like with Article 23 and even more recently, more times, just kind of overestimates what they can get away with turning the screws, assuming that there won't really be a cost. And there's a great way of thinking about it that Kanna Leung, a Hong Kong writer, wrote about in an article for Apple Daily, I think, that was translated in China Heritage, where she talked about the frog in the pot of boiling water. Mm. If the temperature is raised slowly enough, the frog will simply die. But if something happens that sort of alerts the frog that the temperature is going up quickly, then the frog will jump out, or in this case, protests will break out. So the question is, why at certain moments do they feel that they can ratchet up the temperature quickly rather than just doing it really slowly? And those have been the moments that have triggered the protests.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also, I mean, Beijing is incredibly pragmatic. And it, during 97, I mean, even in its alliance with the tycoons, really thought that if we win the loyalty of the tycoons, the masses will follow. So he really pursued this strategy of, well, if economically and politically we have, we're able to, we're able to take Hong Kong with us, then everything else will follow quite smoothly. I think what it underestimates is the cultural identity that is birthed in an environment that has economic freedom and some political liberties. I think Beijing has always been very, I think, unable to understand, I mean, truly, I mean, in its accusations, both I think actually in Wuhan and in Hong Kong of hostile foreign forces that are actually doing kind of that are riling people up. This sense of there isn't. Why would you want to protest? Like, why would you want to get yourself into trouble? I mean, if there's no immediate economic gain, that doesn't make sense. Beijing, I think, fundamentally is really incapable of imagining this organic uprising out of cultural identity rather than, economic incentives. And in its estimation of how Hong Kong would transform after the handover, it made some very prudent calculations, but it did not really think through about this new generation of people who have grown accustomed to certain pillars of a liberal democratic society and how unwilling it might be to give that up, even with a relative amount of economic prosperity.
And that people sometimes do things that are against their economic interests. Protesters take these chances. One of the ways that protesters get punished is they get banned from going to the mainland, which means if you're a young Hong Kong person who wants to work for an international company, the international company in Hong Kong wants to hire somebody who's going to help them get into Beijing. So even companies that are banned from China, say Facebook, in their Hong Kong office, they want somebody who can be a kind of intermediary. So, yeah, I wrote a partly joking piece about would Mark Zuckerberg hire Joshua Wong after the Umbrella Movement? Because Joshua Wong is really savvy with social media. He's a globally known. Mark Zuckerberg wouldn't want to touch him because he wants to have somebody who can move between there. But I would say just my favorite piece of Jia Yang's is the profile of Denise Ho, the Cantonese pop singer who has completely worked against her own economic interest by taking stands that first got her banned from the mainland. When she came out as gay and was very public on LGBTQ issues. That didn't get her banned from the mainland, where she would tour. A lot of her money would come from touring in the mainland or downloads from the mainland. But when tear gas was used against protesters in 2014, she decided, you know, she was going to speak out about the umbrella movement. That got her music banned from the mainland. So that was her making a choice about economic things. But then, just to show that the signals that Beijing sometimes get is that economics rule all, mm-hmm. She was Lancome L'Oreal's face across East Asia for the products. And Lancome L'Oreal was going to launch a new thing in the mainland, and the mainland said, you drop her, or you don't get to do this. And they dropped her, which would reinforce Beijing's view that bottom line is what people pay attention to.
There are so many stories like that.
There are so many like that. So they get reinforced periodically that it is all about economics by, in part, their interactions with the West.
Yeah.
So we have something to answer for.
So is there any force mitigating against a view on the central government's part that they can just afford to let Hong Kong kind of wither on the vine and kind of slide into some sort of, you know, new normal of street protests and a little bit of violence and economic decline and irrelevance? I mean, I know that would hurt all of us profoundly, but we're, you know, liberal New Yorkers, of course. We love Hong Kong. They're not a New Yorker anymore, but... do we project too much of our own views and our own emotions onto assessing the kind of trajectory of this story?
There was a good Ian Johnson piece that was a little bit controversial, actually, of trying to evaluate the status of Hong Kong. And I think he says something that piqued some people. He said that it was a city in decline, and many Hong Kongers felt very strongly that that actually the city is experiencing this flourishing. And I think you can make an argument for both those adjectives in a way. I wrote a piece at the end of last year in which I talk about, you know, the city kind of awakening to itself, you know, being really newly self-conscious about its identity, which it didn't used to think it had full ownership of. But economically speaking, you know, when you look at Hong Kong's status as a global financial hub, I mean, it's how critical it was as really the only kind of backdoor into China in the 80s and 90s, and now how it is still very, you know, very important. It has a rule of law, and it still has things that cities like Shenzhen and Shanghai doesn't quite have. But it is competing in some ways with these newly emergent financially powerful Chinese cities, and in that respect, it can be regarded as a city that's less important than it once was. I think from Beijing's perspective, Beijing's best case scenario is that given the great influx of mainlanders into Hong Kong, over the years, that sense of Hong Kong identity, if not weakened, will at least be diluted. Mm-hmm. And if you have, if Hong Kong natives, you know, are marrying mainlanders, then their children are speaking, you know, Cantonese and Mandarin as their household language, its willful resistance to Beijing and to mainland will gradually soften, you know, over time. I think there is that.
And maybe
but
more
so
people
far,
will
the
leave.
Opposite is happening, right? I mean, I remember I got to Hong Kong in June of 2000, so 3 years after the handover, at the height of the Asian economic crisis. Financial crisis. And, you know, the city was a real mess. All these people were in negative equity on their homes. They were paying more, you know, more on their mortgages than their homes were worth. And I was sent out my very first week to do a kind of 3 years past the handover story. And I remember talking with the social scientist who has been doing for years these mass surveys of how Hong Kong people think about their place in the world and giving them choices of, you know, I'm Chinese, I'm a Chinese who lives in Hong Kong, I'm a Hong Kong Chinese person, I'm a Hong Kong, I forget what each of the categories are. But there has been this enormous shift even over that 20 years ago, 20-year period, of particularly young people just identifying not as Chinese anymore, but just as Hong Kong people. And I know at least of a handful of mainland friends who live in Hong Kong who are now kind of raising their children as Hong Kong.
Right.
Particularly given what's happening on the mainland, but there may be a special...
But I think that generation is, I mean, many of the young protesters that I interviewed last September, they very much, you do have to generate this generational rift where they're really reacting, where they are, you know, much better educated than their parents, some of whom are, you know, first generation mainland immigrants, and feel like they are, they have a sophisticated globalized education, and they are really taking control of their Hong Kong identity, especially, you know, growing up still with so many of the advantages of, you know, a liberal, semi-democratic society. But what was striking to me was that I would conduct my interviews with them in both Mandarin and English. They would always... they would insist on wanting to speak mainly English, I think, as much out of, you know, a sign of political protest as anything else. But because they, I mean, you know, these are kids who were born in around 97, they attended primary schools that taught them Mandarin. So they were very fluent in Mandarin, and some of them, you know, love listening to Taiwanese songs. And I think there is, as mainland pop culture becomes increasingly sophisticated, there is also some cross-pollination. I wonder when they grow up, if they're like the shape of their children's Hong Kong identity. I mean, if the government still insists on Mandarin education, and as mainland it sheds its reputation of just being the country bumpkin cousin and becomes, you know, more sophisticated and sleek, at least culturally, I wonder if the children of today's Hong Kong millennials will feel as kind of instinctively protective of their Hong Kong identity as their parents. I don't know. I think that's an open question.
We also just, again, another way in which China has been changing is the government is more insistent upon there being a single version of Chinese-ness. And I think it's almost like a problem of vocabulary that, and this is something I haven't quite figured out how you can do it, but there's a project now that goes along with Chinese-ness coming out of Beijing, and you see it with, I mean, the Confucius Institutes were one. And it used to be you could say, like, well, I'm the kind of Chinese person who values traditional China. You know, I value Confucian values rather than Communist Party values. But now you're supposed to, it's an all or nothing package. Mm-hmm. There isn't the space for this. And it's very hard to talk about, but I'll talk about it anyway, maybe especially in New York. So I don't usually bring this in, but I mean, I'm of Jewish heritage. It's been very easy in the United States for quite a while to say, I'm Jewish but anti-Zionist. Plenty of people will say that, even though there were points when Israel wanted to be the representative of Judaism. But that didn't work. To some extent, there's been a going along with China's, with the Chinese Communist Party's view of defining what Chinese-ness is. And so if you don't have the option, I mean, maybe you could say, I'm a Chinese anti-communist, but it doesn't really work because the Chinese Communist Party now is claiming to stand for more things like that. Mm. So in a way, what option do you have if you don't buy into this project? So, but the other thing that I think is very important is you can be a Hong Konger without being ethnically Chinese, and you can't be Chinese without, in the People's Republic of China. You can't be a full citizen of that. So there are significant people, including one of our mutual close friends, Zohar Abdul-Karim, who used to edit Time Asia until he retired. And he wrote a beautiful essay on the Hong Kong dream as opposed to the China dream. And he talked about being somebody who has had familial ties to Hong Kong from his grandfather or his great-grandfather's time, even though he doesn't have any quote-unquote Chinese blood. And he speaks Cantonese, but he doesn't recognize Chinese characters, I think he was saying. But he speaks English and he speaks Cantonese, so he's a Hong Konger. And he can be accepted as Hong Kongers. Not that there aren't, you know, prejudices within Hong Kong, but it's possible to feel that way. And there are people descended from British colonizers, but there are also people with ties to Europe or ties to Baghdad, and they can claim to be a Hong Konger. So it's an identity that opens up possibilities.
Thank you for listening to Asia in Depth. You can listen to other episodes of the Asia in Depth podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Check out our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Society. Next week, we bring you a conversation between two celebrated authors, Salman Rushdie and Tashani Doshi, whose new book is called Small Days and Nights. Here's a sneak peek.
Being in India these last 10 years and going with my body as a woman, navigating through this space and feeling really a kind of fury and anger at the fact that there's just so much violence, for one, that we have to navigate, and just so much repression and so many things that you're trying to not be bombarded and squashed down by. And at the same time, I would say that the story of women in India is such a one for rejoicing, because it's just, there's so much happening and so much that Indian women are doing. So it's this weird juxtaposition of, on one level, these horrible statistics and newspaper articles which just keep coming, and at the other end, the sort of strong resilience.
I'm Dan Washburn. See you next time.